I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may, Judge Applewick. Thank you very much.
Proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Howard Goodfriend here on behalf of Lake Hills, the appellant. Plaintiff below, Alan Bornstein, trial counsel, is with me. The trial court's rulings in this case, particularly its instructions, which I'm going to focus on today, unfairly favored the respondent AP and prejudiced Lake Hills.
Can I take you to instruction 9 first?
Yeah, that's that is the first one I'm going to talk about.
When I get to the closing argument, and I see that Lake Hills argues about the affirmative defense of AP under instruction 9, counsel argued, but if AP followed the plans and specifications and the defect primarily resulted from the defects in these plans and specs, then they're not liable. Is that the theory, the trial theory that Lake Hills was asserting under the affirmative defense in number 9?
Well, I mean, Lake Hills was opposing the affirmative defense of AP in instruction number 9, and it was taking issue with the, you know, of course, that is what they argued, but that's not what the jury was told. The jury was told that AP is not responsible if the damage results solely from the defective plans or specifications.
It doesn't say solely. You wanted it to say solely. 9 ended up without including solely, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. We're talking about 9 now. Correct. Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. The jury should have been instructed that if the damage results solely from the defective plans or specs, then, you know, they would establish that affirmative defense. It was particularly critical, Judge Verone, with respect to Lake Hill's largest claim for cracking in the concrete in the garage, because it was basically conceded by AP that the plans and specs were not really followed, particularly with respect to the size of the panels, the construction joint details, requiring early entry saw cuts, things like that, using smooth dowels that were greased rather than standard rebar. That really wasn't in dispute, and the jury could have agreed with Lake Hills that AP's failure to follow these plans caused the concrete to fail, but nonetheless was allowed to fine for AP based on its argument that the plans contributed in any minor way to the defective product in the end.
I guess that takes me to what is it instruction 9 has given when it said, and that the defect resulted from defects in the plans and specifications. What causation level is embedded in that language?
Well, it's unclear, I think, and that's the problem. I mean, when you look at that in combination with the language that, you know, there wasn't, you know, sort of the tort proximate cause instruction in this construction case. And what the jury was left with was, you know, this solely issue that it couldn't really find in favor of Lake Hills if, you know, its plans and specifications in any way contributed to it.
And if the instruction misstates the law, then you argue Anfinson presumed prejudice, even though AP in its closing argument didn't even mention its affirmative defense. They referred to instruction 9 once about Lake Hill's burden, but didn't even talk about the affirmative defense part.
So no, but it certainly harped on the position that these plans and specifications, you know, were defective in some respect, and the fact that they did not follow these plans and specifications in terms of doing these things with the construction joints and, you know, the cutting and the greased smooth dowels, their position was, well, you know, yeah, we might not have done that, but that wasn't really the problem. So, you know, in the end, I think it was particularly prejudicial given that, you know, the jury could have agreed with Lake Hills that AP's failure contributed in some way to the concrete failure, but nonetheless fine for AP. And, you know, we got a goose egg on those very substantial claims for cracking concrete in the jury's special verdict form.
But the jury did make an award with respect to the, was it the parking area, which also had concrete claims. Doesn't that demonstrate they understood the difference and were able to parse between the defect and construction performance claims based on the expert testimony?
You know, I think what the jury did in terms of those was it found in favor of Lake Hills and awarded really the minimal amount of damages that AP was arguing it could recover. And with respect to those garage areas, there were other defects that were at issue, which were such like the vapor barrier, you know, the capillary breaks, things like that. So it was a slightly different theory of defective construction and a slightly different defense.
So they didn't impose the version of instruction 9 that you're arguing for. They didn't say, well, there's some defect here, therefore we're not going to allow any recovery on that, as they did with the garage component.
Well, I think, you know, with the garage component, it's likely that they found that the plans and specifications were absolutely fine. You know, what happened was AP just failed to follow them and, you know, awarded the minimal damages that AP said they should award if it found in their favor. So there's a substantial difference, I think, between those claims. You know, I do want to briefly touch upon another failure to give instruction, which was particularly significant here, and that is refusing Lake Hills' proposed instruction that a defendant cannot rely on a plaintiff's prior material breach to excuse a subsequent breach if the defendant continued to perform. You know, that was particularly prejudicial here because jury found that Lake Hills materially breached the contract on July 25th, 2014, yet AP continued to perform for, you know, many, many months, 15 months before it stopped work. And, you know, based on the jury's finding that there was a prior material breach, the trial court refused to impose delay damages against AP, even for those delays for which AP was found solely responsible. So that was a particularly egregious error that definitely prejudiced Lake Hills in terms of its ability to recover for delay damages because, you know, this breach that the jury found in cutting a invoice payment after AP said, we don't really have a problem with that, we'll carry on, you know, it prevented really Lake Hills from arguing this theory of the case that a party cannot rely on a prior breach, continue performing, and then say, aha, you know, we're off the hook for any problems that occurred thereafter while it continues to perform. I'll reserve the rest of my time if I can.
Thank you. We went 30 seconds long there. We'll do the same for opposing counsel because I suspect the panel has questions.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Leonard Feldman, and I'm counsel for AP Rushforth. I think it's obvious from the briefing that this was a very long and a very challenging trial. It lasted 28 days. There were 31 witnesses, endless fact issues, and many contested rulings and jury instructions. But at the end of the day, the jury found in favor of AP based on the evidence, not on any trial court.
Well, if the jury instructions are wrong and they're presumed prejudicial, you're going to get a do-over. So tell
that's
us
right.
why
the
they're not wrong.
The jury instructions aren't wrong, and that's the point. Yeah. So jury instruction number 9 did not include the word solely. This, we contend, is squarely addressed by a line of cases that includes Maryland Casualty, Dravo, and the Tufel case, and they all hold that a contractor is not liable for the consequences of defects in the plans and specifications. Now, they've relied on Kenny and Valley. Both of those quote a section of the ALR, and that's where this word solely comes from. But the salient point is that Kenny and Valley don't adopt the ALR as the rule of law in Washington. What they adopt as the rule of law in Washington is the White standard. What White says is that a contractor is excused from substantial performance by the acts of the other contracting party. So when you read all these cases together, the rule that emerges from them is a relatively simple and well-known rule, which is that each side is responsible for their own misconduct. In the case of the owner, that might mean non-payment, but it also would include defective plans and specifications. And in the case of the contractor, it would include defective work.
So what did AP have to prove under the affirmative defense and Instruction 9 to invoke an absolute bar, affirmative defense? We have no liability whatsoever because 1% of this is related to defective plans, primarily defective plans.
Yeah, so that's the question about what's the causation standard. And I disagree with Mr. Goodfriend that there is no causation standard in 9. Number 3 in Instruction 9, that Lake Hills was damaged as a result of AP's breach. I mean, this is no different than tort. Each side is responsible for their own misconduct. AP can argue, as it did, that any deficiencies in the work were caused by Lake Hills drawings. And Lake Hills can argue that any deficiencies in the work were caused by AP's deficient work.
And then there's apportionment based on percentages?
Exactly. And that's why you see that Lake Hills won on some of its claims, but not on others. So, you know, as the trial court mentioned, juries are whizzes with causation. This jury, what it did clearly was it figured out what did AP do wrong, and AP got tagged with that, and what did Lake Hills do wrong, and AP did not get tagged with that. And there's nothing controversial or novel about that.
Isn't though an apportionment, which the trial court in discussing earlier on what they should do with 9 said, I want language that provides for apportionment. It says 50 this and 50 that. That's how much you recover. That's the language I think we should see. You're saying that's what this language establishes?
I think it's embedded in this instruction, yes. I think what this instruction says is that Lake Hills has to prove that it was damaged as a result of AP's breach.
Isn't that just proving, though, causation for contract damages?
Sure.
Rather than a true affirmative defense. A true affirmative defense is if I establish it, I'm in the good clear.
Yeah, so Lake Hills has its burden, and then AP has its. And what it says about AP is that AP has the burden to prove that Lake Hills provided plans and specifications, and that AP followed the plans and specifications, and that the defect resulted, that's key, resulted from defects in the plans and specifications. Again,
resulted totally, resulted partially, is it vague?
The jury gets to figure that out, and at the end of the day, they allocate damages between AP and Lake Hills, which is exactly what they did.
Did the instruction allow the jury to say if there is a defect in the design, then no damages are allowed against AP, no matter how badly they otherwise failed to produce?
No, because the affirmative defense requires that the defect in the work resulted from defects in the plans and specifications. So there's a tie there, a nexus that AP had to establish. AP had to show that the defects that Lake Hills was alleging, quote, resulted from defects in the plans and specifications. So
it's an item by item, not a winner take all.
Exactly. And so that explains why the jury did what it did. And I think, Judge Varellan, you also pointed out that at the end of the day, this really wasn't an issue in closing arguments. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that what Lake Hills wanted with the word solely was to put its thumb on the scale of causation. What they were left with was a fair fight. And so both parties went into the closing arguments much as they would in a tort case. And each party said it was Lake Hills that caused it, and Lake Hills said it was AP that caused it. And at the end of the day, you know, the jury figured out who was the causative factor, the proximate cause of the harm. And the word solely doesn't enter into that. So I would say two things. One is the word solely comes from an ALR article that is not the law in Washington. So the instruction was correct. And secondly, I do think that this is a clear example of harmless error, if it was error at all. So that takes me to the instruction 15 issue.
And the harmless error gets around the presumptive prejudice because we look at the way the verdict form breaks
out
down. Yeah,
so the law distinguishes between clearly erroneous instructions and instructions that
mislead.
Are misleading. And for misleading, you have to show prejudice. And at most, this would be misleading. So the issue on excuse, this was their proposed instruction. And it was legally erroneous for three reasons, which is why the trial court could correctly reject it.
Although they did make an objection, the formal objections were that this doesn't relate, doesn't state the materiality requirement.
Well, so they made that, so they made that on instruction 15. So this is like a multi-instruction argument. Mm. 15 is the interference with contractual performance instruction.
Right.
And it's the WPI. So I understand that WPIs are not always gospel, but that means a lot that it's the WPI. And the reason it doesn't include the word material is because it's not couched as a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. It's couched as interference with contractual performance. That's the affirmative defense that's in 15. And if Lake Hill's conduct interferes with the contractual performance, it is by definition material. So materiality is baked into WPI 302.08.
I noticed that the trial court, in discussing again these instructions, said, well, the part of the theory here is that there's endless nitpicking, just constant nitpicking, this hurdle, that hurdle. Wouldn't those include things that maybe aren't in themselves material? They're just a nitpick here, a nitpick.
Right, there. But under if they're nitpicky and they're under 15 and they don't interfere with performance, then they don't count. But what Lake Hills has done is sort of pivot from 15 over to the instructions that relate to material breach. There's nothing wrong with the instructions that relate to material breach. You know, that's instructions 13, which defines material breach, and 17, which states that it's AP's burden to show materiality. The issue that Mr. Goodfriend was mentioning, that if you continue to perform, it's a waiver, it fails for three reasons. One, waiver by conduct requires unequivocal conduct, and their instruction didn't say that. Two, and I think this is very important, and I believe it's completely ignored in their briefing, there's a section in the contract, it's 4.3.3, that says that AP has to continue to perform if it initiates the dispute resolution process. So AP had a choice. It could walk off the job, which it didn't do, or it could initiate a dispute resolution, and if it did that, which is what it did, it had to continue to perform. So their instruction was contrary to the contract. And then lastly, I think your questions are very good because they sort of show, I think, Lake Hill's confusion between the 15 issue and the 13 and 17 issue. They proposed their alternative instruction as an alternative to the good faith and fair dealing defense. And that's not how it works. They're separate and independent defenses. So they were trying to use the material breach instruction to displace the good faith and fair dealing instruction. And a trial court's not required to accept an erroneous instruction.
Do you wish to ask any more questions? All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Everything you want to know about a 28-day trial in 20 minutes.
and everything you need to know about it in 3 minutes. So let me address instruction 9 first. You know, the solely part of it is required not only by law but also by the contract. If you look at Valley and Kenny, what they say is that, you know, if it's the result of plans and specifications, if it's solely the result of the plans and specs, it's on the owner. In the absence, and then they go on to say, in the absence of any negligence on the part of the contractor. If you look at the contract here, if you look at section 3.3.1, it also says the contractor shall be solely responsible for and have control over constructions, means, methods, techniques, etc., unless the contract documents give other specific instructions concerning these matters. So it wasn't just supported by the case law. It was supported by the contract. And it did definitively prejudice Lake Hills because they conceded that they didn't follow the specifications. They just said, well, you know, it really wasn't a big deal because, hey, look, it called for rebar, and that's why it cracked. And, I think in the absence of any particular causation standard, it allowed the jury to find, well, you know, they did have rebar here, and yeah, well, maybe they did this too, but, it does say if it's caused by the plans and specs, they're off the hook. The issue about the ability of the contractor to continue performing once there's been a material breach, you've heard that section 4.3.3 basically, you know, trumps the very well-established common law rule under the restatement in Williston that you can't reach back and cite to a material breach that you decided to ignore and continue performing. But if you look at section 4.3.3, it talks about the contractor's right to continue performing once it submitted a claim. There was no claim made here on July 25th, 2014, the day that Lake Hills, with AP's agreement, with AP's new project manager saying, no problem, we're going to make this work, reduced its payment by $125,000. That was the day the jury found there was a material breach, and that was the day after which the trial court barred Lake Hills from recovering any delay damages. There was no claim submitted on July 25th, and we were demonstrably prejudiced by that ruling. So for these are just two of the instructions that we've challenged. For the other reasons stated in our brief, we ask this court to reverse remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes.